Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, Vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks so much. We appreciate your support. We couldn't do it without you. If you want to connect with me, the website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com, or you can go to Twitter and find me there at Macroaggression. Thank you to our sponsors. Legal Shield has been in business for 50 years, serving the American and Canadian audiences. They are it's the collective buying power of all of us, directed towards high-powered law firms in your area. It allows you access to a lawyer for $30 a month, you know, a dollar a day, very reasonably priced. If you need documents, your will, last will and testament, a medical power of attorney, a financial power of attorney, anything like that, you got to get that stuff done in advance. Okay. You just don't want to wait and let, you know, have yourself pass away and then your family has to deal with the state getting involved in your affairs. That's just not going to work. So you've got to do these things. They cost $1,000 or so a document if you want to go your own way. Why not sign up for Legal Shield and pay $30 a month and knock out all those documents in month number one? I don't know why you wouldn't do that. You probably should go to the website and take a look and see if you think it's right for you. Don'tgetpushedaround.com is the domain where you can find information about not just Legal Shield's legal plan, but also their ID Shield, their small business plan. If you're a gun owner, a gun carrier, they have documentation for that. If you have problems with tax issues, talk to your attorney. If your work wants you to sign some document that, something having to do with your employment contract, and they've inserted some new language in there having to do with medical components due to COVID, well, send that to your attorney as well. Anything that you think you would normally want somebody to proofread or take a look at before you send it out, you now have an attorney that you can do that. So go to the website, take a look, and just see if you think it's right for you. My God, at a dollar a day, it's very reasonable. You can't complain about the price. The only question is, do you think you will get your money's worth? I would suggest that you will get more than your money's worth if you are in the business of getting these documents taken care of. So the website, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com. Also, thank you to C60 Purple Power. I just went and I do sessions, like I do podcasts with Ken Schwartz, the scientist. He's the founder of C60 Purple Power. We go out, we do a podcast together, then we go to lunch and he talks to me about nuclear physics, and I pretend to understand it. But if you are in the market for C60, I'm tell you what, C60 Purple Power is making the best batch of C60 out there. It is a naturally occurring molecule comprised of 60 carbon atoms that forms something that looks like a hollow soccer ball. It travels through your body, finding free radicals, neutralizing them, resetting itself, and then doing it again and again and again. It is the most powerful antioxidant known. It is hundreds of times more powerful than the most powerful antioxidant that you think you know of. And the guys that discovered the C60 molecule, they won the Nobel Prize for it. So it's kind of a big deal. It helps to maximize the efficiency of your cell. So I'll tell you what, you can do this. You can go to shopc60.com, take a look, use the promo code MACRO if you find something that you like. But I take this product every single morning, and I have been now for almost 3 years. So it's great. It works. It's the best product out there. C60 Purple Power is the company. Shopc60.com is the website. Promo code MACRO on your way out. These statements and products have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, prevent, or mitigate any disease. But it works really well for everything else. Wink, wink. ShopC60.com, promo code MACRO. Well, let's talk Kennedy, shall we? I know just enough about Kennedy to be dangerous, but when you want to talk about the biggest and most important conspiracy in the history of American politics, my go-to guy is Corey Hughes. Corey is the host of Understanding Propaganda. He's my co-host. And day zero, if you want to check out that podcast, which will most definitely get us thrown off the internet. And he is writing the best book on Kennedy that I've read. It's Corey Hughes.
Everybody out there, like, if you're not listening to day zero, what is wrong with you? It is the best show on the internet.
We have so much fun. So it's me, it's Corey, it's X-Cube420 and Lindsay Sharman and Chris Matthew from Forbidden Knowledge News is sort of like comes... He was one of the original hosts, and he got too bogged down with stuff, and Lindsay sort of stepped in, and we just have too much fun. Yeah, I agree. If you're not listening to that show, like, what's your problem? we say things on there that, man, I just am telling you.
Yeah, when you get done with this episode, hop over to day zero. You're going to have a blast. We do every week. So
yeah, we do. And Understanding Propaganda, I like that show. You've had me on there a bunch. And that, I think it's important, especially, goddamn, after what we've been through in the last 2-3 years, if you don't understand how propaganda works, you're at a real disadvantage for figuring out reality. So
my consistency with Understanding Propaganda has been lacking because I've been working on my book like crazy. And honestly, I look at some of this propaganda and it's just so overwhelming. I just get mad and I'm like, fuck this. And I just don't do the show because I'm so fucking angry. But I'm going to be rebooting it here, I think, into my like daily. I think I'm going to start doing it over again very soon. And I'm going to be doing a live broadcast on Rumble. Just wake up in the morning and sort through my Twitter and see what propaganda we've been dumped on and go for it. So
it's never ending. I mean, you can do the show as a daily show for sure, because it's every day I see something that's more ridiculous than the day before. I mean, eggs will will kill you now. Eggs will give you strokes.
Breathing too many times in a day can give you a heart attack now.
What is that?
Breathing too many times in a day
can give you a heart attack now. Yeah, yeah. I knew. I suspected that all my whole life. I wondered about that. Jesus Christ. It's so... Listen, I'll tell you what. It's pretty... I take it a little bit personally because my dad died from a heart attack. And I understand what really goes on with that stuff and how traumatic it is and how it's not racism. I'm almost positive my dad's heart attack wasn't caused by climate change, racism, or eggs. You know, but yet they're out there telling people, oh, well, that poor kid who dropped dead on the football field looked like he died of racism. It's like, okay, we're going to put the defibrillators next to the playgrounds because these kids are having heart attacks. But that's normal. Remember how normal that is, Corey? And you're just going, no.
Yeah, and in the UK, all those old phone booths that they don't use anymore are turning into defibrillator stations.
Great. So it's perfect. That the nature is healing itself, right? We're now getting to the point. I'm with you, man. I read the news sometimes and I just want to scream. It's so, but again, they're not sending the varsity team for the propaganda. You know, this is definitely the JV or freshman team that's out there talking about this stuff. So I feel a little bit more comfortable knowing that it's so dumb that even the dummies out there are waking up to it. So I feel a little bit, better knowing that. But yeah, you got to get back on the understanding propaganda.
Yeah, for sure.
And those that want to check it out, like go listen to some of the back episodes too, because they're really good. Because you're like, from your understanding of Kennedy, you by default, you have to understand propaganda. I mean, you right. can't understand Kennedy without understanding propaganda and knowing how that whole thing works. And so, you know, there's now three major conspiracies that drive, that sort of reset the bar for where we're headed. Kennedy was the first one, 9/11 was the second one, and COVID was the third one. And in all three of these cases, we've got the media being involved, being co-conspirators in this whole thing, and Kennedy really being the beginning of this, sort of the crossroads of this, because you've got not just the death of Kennedy, you've then got that sort of reminds me of the space program and all the lies surrounding the space program. And it brings in, you know, Kennedy was the first time we really got a chance to see. Obviously, you and I weren't alive when he was alive, but we, looking back, it appears that was the first time that the general public even was presented with the concept that maybe the United States government was not as nice of a group of people as we're told that they were. I mean, we just came out of like, oh, you saved Europe. You won the war. You won World War II. Well, really, we parachuted in the last year. But
yeah.
But America had this like reputation. Oh, we're doing this. And the 50s were great. And look at how prosperous we are and all these things. And then you get Kennedy and you go, wait a second, we might be the bad guys here. So so how'd you get into Kennedy research?
Well, I've always been fascinated with Kennedy. I think everybody has been, especially since the release of the JFK film back in like 92.
Yeah.
Of course, by Oliver Stone, executive producer Arne Milchan, who was a confessed Mossad spy who smuggled nuclear triggers out of the country. That film was a propaganda film, and it got people spinning in a bunch of directions, had all kinds of nonsense in it. Half the stuff in that film is absolutely just false, never happened. And yet that film perpetuated that myth. Unfortunately, it took me like, 30 years to realize that. In July of 2018, I'd already been studying the Holocaust for a couple of years and was ready to move on to something else. And I needed to do Kennedy. And
something fun. Leave the Holocaust and move on to something lighter, you know, like the Kennedy assassination.
Right. Well, it took me a long time to realize that the story of World War II and the story of John Kennedy are the same story. Really, what we are experiencing since the late 1800s has been the continuous operation, if you ask me. And that includes both world wars, all wars, technically. What's been happening is we have been under direct attack by what I call the global Zionist establishment that began in 1897 with Theodore Herzl, and their aim was to gain a state in Palestine, which we all know in 1948, the world was gifted with the state of Israel, which in my opinion has been the worst thing to happen in the 20th century politically. It's caused more trouble than anything, led to the killing of Kennedy, 9/11, COVID, you name it. So, when you go back through history and you start to kind of understand the purpose of the Zionist movement and what they've really been aiming for, it just brings the walls down between what people look at as these individual conspiracies. Like Kennedy, 9/11, and COVID-19 are one continuous operation. And it is about the destruction of America to pave the way for the rise of the Zionist state on a global scale, right? So they already have a state of Israel, which is an abomination, if you ask me. But in the modern era, that wasn't good enough. You see, they needed to infiltrate all the governments around the world. And they did. That's why the West is always in lockstep with everything they do, because they've been compromised at the highest levels, above the presidents and above the Congress.
Yeah, I think 9/11 for a lot of people, they said, wait a second, this feels like this was both an inside and outside job. You know, inside meaning these PNAC guys, and outside meaning external Zionist influence in this, you know, the destruction of buildings, the advanced knowledge, the, I mean, their fingerprints are all over 9/11.
Yeah, well, the real proof in the pudding is the dancing Israelis, and people try to like minimize what they did and who they are. They're real people. Odette Elner, Yarn Schmel, Paul and Sylvan Kurtzberg, and Omar Mamari. I mean, they're real people. They have real names. Yarn Schmel got married on the one-year anniversary of 9/11, and there's pictures of him at his wedding flicking Bic lighters, just like they did at the scene. So yeah, I mean, it was an Israeli plot the whole time. And it was meant to drag us into the Middle East, and it worked, right? Yeah. So if you'll notice, it's like an incremental takeover. It started with Kennedy. Really, it started way before that. You can go back to the 1930s and you can trace the Zionist activities in our government. They had already infiltrated the Supreme Court. They had Henry Morgenthau, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, who actually wrote what's called the Morgenthau Plan, that wanted to basically execute all Germans post-World War II.
Right.
millions of them. He just wanted to put them to death. It's crazy. Right. I mean, these people are fucking lunatics. And over the last 100 years, they've slowly captured everything. Institutional capture at every level, from schools, education, to our medical establishment. All of it, the media, CDC, FDA, FAA, all of these organizations are all compromised at the highest levels. Above our government. So people are like, well, there's no Zionists running our government. Bullshit.
Yeah, so they've been deeply involved for a while. And I think with the Kennedy assassination, you know, the established, you know how they like to do it. They'll present a couple options for you to vigorously fight over. But then anything outside of that is off limits. So the established boogeymen that you're allowed to debate whether or not they were involved in Kennedy's assassination are the Cubans, the Russians, the CIA, we're allowed to talk about, but you're never allowed to mention the Mossad. No. You're never allowed to mention the Zionist component of it. That is never discussed. It's off the table. For you to bring that up would be a conversation ender in most cases. If you were on a media present a show and they asked you to talk about that the minute you got off on Zion, they'd go to commercial. So we understand that there is a silencing of any sort of talk of this. But then you start writing this book and you start sending me over chapters and you're going, take a look at this, take a look at this. And I'm going, God damn, it is so deep in, you know, you go so deep. It's such a layered thing. Everyone sort of like makes this assumption. Lone gunmen, maybe they don't believe there's a lone gunman. Maybe they believe there's two gunmen or three gunmen, right? And a car comes down and they take a shot at him. That seems very simple, right? That's like a very simplified version of the plan. And then I start reading all of your chapters and you're going like a year back before that. You're following where Oswald's going. You're following where a bunch of people are going. You're following a bunch of where the body doubles are going. I mean, it's so detailed that you almost have to like it. It's dense, man. Your book, when it is finished, how far are you along on it? And when do you think it'll be out?
Well, it's like, it keeps getting longer as I go.
No,
like,
that's the thing about books.
I wrote two chapters. I had all these ideas to put into two chapters and I got done with two chapters and I'm like, whoa, I'm not even close to finishing this idea. So I had to just add a third chapter to wrap up specifically the book depository and a chapter I called Oswald's Escape. So for me, when you look at the general story of Kennedy and you start to look at the official story when it comes to like the activities in the book depository and like actual individual instances of things that people did, witnesses, you know, whatever, it all gets brushed over for like a blatant fiction. So allegedly Oswald leaves the book depository and he flees on a bus and then the bus gets stuck in traffic and then he gets off the bus and gets in a cab. And that whole story is a fiction. Like none of that stuff ever happened. The chapter I'm working on now is covering that stuff. And when you dig into the individual statements, you'll find that these were pre-planned, staged events that were done in advance. And the story, like with the bus, is really fascinating in particular, because the only evidence that Oswald was on a bus was a bus transfer ticket was found in his pocket. Well, when you dig into the actual transfer ticket itself, it turns out that the book the transfer ticket was pulled from is missing by the statements of Cecil McWaters, who was the bus driver. And I think this is it seems like a minor kind of incident, but I'm going to kind of explain it just so you can kind of get a feel for how this thing worked. So when when Cecil McWaters comes to work that day, he gets a book of transfers, and the very first one is numbered 004451. He pulls that one out and he signs it and he turns it in to his company as a receipt that he has that book of transfers, right? Because they keep tabs on everything. So that whole day, he only issues two transfers, one to Oswald and one to a woman passenger who's never been identified. The transfer he turned in was 551, but the transfer that was given to Oswald was 559. So all of the transfers from the initial one that was used as a receipt to turn in all the way up into the one that was allegedly given to Oswald are missing. He can't account for them. And according to Cecil McWaters, he only gave out two transfers that day. Right. So if he gave out two transfers that day, why is Oswald's transfer the last one in that book? I'll tell you why. Because the staged event was set up in advance. And that morning, he handed his book off to the Dallas Police Department. He pulled out his initial receipt, he punched it, and that whole book was given to the Dallas Police Department. Because when you go through the documents, you'll find later on, cops make, just passing statements that they dealt or handled that book of transfers, right? So you can see just from one transfer, an entire series of events was pre-planned, staged, and then they didn't really count on like 50 years later, the internet being able to provide all this data for people to start to reassemble this. So for many years, people couldn't solve Kennedy because they didn't have the tools, even in the early 2000s. In the early 2000s, you have the internet being new, and you have databases starting to come online, but you didn't have near the amount of information that we have today, even though some of the documents were released, right? We had documents out, but they weren't organized in a manner that you could actually go look at them. You have to actually like go to Washington, D.C. in the archives to look at them instead of having these amazing databases today. So I credit the digital age and really the last probably 10 years made it possible to put together the pieces on this thing. Mm-hmm. Because some of the information I gathered, I got from forums and I got from Facebook groups that didn't even exist prior to like 2017, 2018. So the digital age has done wonders for
Kennedy. So it's like you find one. Yeah, I've always kind of described it like this. If my wife goes out of town and I say and she says what did you do last night, and I say I went to Corey's Pizza Place and with my friend Max, and then we went to see Top Gun 12 or whatever at, you know, the 9 o'clock show. And I tell that story to my wife and I say, then after the movie, then we went home. I went home, you know, I tell that story to my wife and she doesn't really know what, you know, she doesn't know where I was. She only knows what I tell her, but she knows that Corey's Pizza Parlor burned down last week. Right. But I don't know that. And I just use that as, if she knows that part of my story is fake, isn't it reasonable for her to assume that the other parts are fake too? That maybe I didn't go to this Top Gun 11 or whatever, and maybe I didn't just go right home. Maybe I was up to no good, right? So if you know one part of the story is a lie, it's reasonable to assume that maybe some of the other parts are. And so what you can find these little pieces of the Kennedy puzzle that are flat out lies. Like just 100% not true. And in and of itself, maybe it doesn't really matter. But it just goes to, like in this particular case, what you're talking about is that they went to extreme lengths to set this up in advance. Like this was well thought out. This was not, we shot the president and then panicked and reacted. This was, we are planning to shoot the president. We have things in advance. We have body doubles in advance. We have fake car. You know, we have cars rented. We need the receipts from the bus driver and things like that. There was a ton of advanced planning for this. So I think, and they made a lot of mistakes mm-hmm. that were easy to cover up in the 60s and not so easy to cover up 60 years later when people have access to the internet and they can go dig into this whole thing. So, let's keep going there because when you've got the bus driver basically telling a story that's not true, you've got, multiple witnesses saying that they saw somebody that looked like Oswald, but it wasn't Oswald, right? You've got multiple people involved that have body doubles and a variety. So how do you even get? So where do you even go with this stuff? I mean, it's so confusing. I would need one of those. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia charts behind me with the strings connecting to, I need one of those to just try and sort this whole thing out. So like, how do you even organize this information in a way that makes sense? Because what I've read makes sense, but it's like, I wouldn't even know where to start with all this stuff.
Well, I consumed somewhere around 100,000 pages of documents, all Kennedy related, mostly Garrison, Weisberg, FBI files, stuff like that. And I began to notice these patterns forming. So when you come to understand who Oswald is, and I don't understand who Oswald is, nobody does. I can tell you that much. Nobody understands who the real Harvey Oswald actually was. There's probably a 90-year-old handler out there somewhere who knows, but, lost to history. But when you come to understand who Lee Harvey Oswald is, you come to realize he always had a nice, neat, clean haircut. He kept himself clean shaven. He was always tidy. He kept his fingernails trimmed. He was a very clean and neat person. Then you start to get into these incidents where people are identifying having interacted with Lee Harvey Oswald. And they're saying he's smoking cigarettes. He's cursing. He's got stubble or whiskers, not clean shaven. And after a while, it's like, holy shit, this is not Lee Harvey Oswald they're talking about. And so then you have to realize, like, if it's not Lee Harvey Oswald, then who actually is it? And so this is where most people get lost, because when conspiracy nuts start talking about body doubles and there were duplicate Oswalds and stuff like that, like, they just lose people because it's just a fate. There's no face that they can apply to that, right? And so, but what I actually did was I went deep enough into the backstories with Cuba and Jerry Hemmingen's Interpen group, the same group that was busted outside of Lake Pontchartrain with David Ferry and all those guys. And I got into the climate of what was happening in America at that time from like 59 onwards. Because all the guys, the mercenaries who were involved in the assassination really got involved with the CIA post 59, involved with Jerry Hemmingen and his Interpen group down in No Name Key, like in the Florida Keys for training purposes. That all happened in the early 60s. And then when you come to understand who David Ferry surrounded himself with, you come to realize that every single one of the boys that David Ferry surrounded himself with looked like Oswald. They were all about 5'7", 5'8", 150, 160 pounds, light brown hair, receding hairlines, interchangeable from a spycraft perspective. Hmm. But then when you come to understand really who these people's relationships are with, and I have to emphasize this more than anything, the study of Kennedy is a study of relationships. If you don't understand the relationships between the people involved, you'll never understand who was shooting from the sixth floor of the book depository or who was the shooter at the Deltex. You need to understand the relationships between these people to understand who these people actually are.
And that's what you're really good at explaining in this book, is these relationships. And that's the reason why you can't just jump right in on that day in November. You have to, there's so much backstory. Like you set up years of backstory. You know, in my head, I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, so they planned this, what, a couple months in advance? And you're like, no. Like, this was set in motion a long time ago. Not necessarily with Kennedy himself in mind, but like you said, the idea of having this island in the Florida Keys where he's training people, he's training spies. And then the sort of, like you said, the interchangeability of one person for another, you know, that's spycraft, right? That's how you do it. That's thinking several steps ahead. That's where the casual observer gets lost, and the person that really understands how these intelligence agencies work has an advantage, because they understand the lengths to which these people will go and the amount of time that they will invest and money to get the right people in a position for this job. So setting up those backstories is really important, because it comes, you have to understand the relationship. If you understand the relationship, it starts to make more sense. If you don't, it's just a bunch of names on a piece of paper that you go, well, how would they have known to trust each other? How would that guy know to, how do you know that that guy would know that the other guy would go pick him up at a certain time? Like, how does he know that that guy won't just ditch him and leave him there? And it has to do with these relationships.
As I'm going through all these different sightings of Lee Harvey Oswald, and it was over 100 in different places. Most people have never heard of, like incidents in Miami. That the real Oswald obviously was never in Miami, but we have two separate incidents documented where Lee Harvey Oswald was involved in some sort of protest or demonstration on behalf of Fair Play for Cuba committee. And this is going back to like 1960, at a time when Oswald was in the Soviet Union, number one, and number two, hadn't even been associated with the Fair Play for Cuba committee. So Fair Play for Cuba committee was a CIA front founded by Richard Gibson and Robert Tabor, two guys who worked for CBS in New York. And it was a CIA front the entire time. It was a COINTELPRO kind of thing to keep tabs on communists. So when people try to say that he was a communist because he was associated with this COINTELPRO organization, it's ridiculous to me. When you start to get into like who the leadership of Fair Play for Cuba committee was, they were all CIA spooks, even low-level guys, you know.
Yeah. So was Kennedy or was Oswald a communist?
No, well, certainly not. He was an intelligence asset, and he did what he was told. That's pretty much all we know about him. We don't know much about the personal life of Lee Harvey Oswald, because he didn't have one. His whole life was a front, you know?
That reminds me of these like MK Ultra type people that grow up in these families and are basically like used as spooks for intelligence agencies. Like, it's not just the dad, but like the whole family, like the whole community. In fact, I saw something, they were showing this community in Spain, and they're saying that whole area, this guy was saying, pointing down there, he's on a hill. He's like, that whole area, that whole town right there is all intelligence. And I was like, what? He's like, the whole town is like filled with intelligence. It's like, they just took over the whole town, and that's Spain. And I'm going, oh shit. So it's like kind of like a factory. It's almost like a Hollywood sound studio where everybody grows up on the sound studio and they're all actors and parts and members of this whole thing. So it sounds crazy, but it is not unreasonable to think that somebody like a Lee Harvey Oswald character might have been brought up specifically to play a role in, maybe not in this event, but in some event. And this turned out to be the event that he was, his starring performance.
100% believe that. He had a first cousin named Dorothea Moret, whose father was Charles Dutz Moret, who worked directly for Carlos Marcello. But his first cousin, Dorothea, it is heavily suspected that she was also in the false defector program as like a higher up, as a supervisor, because she ended up during the height of the Cold War in the late 50s and early 60s, she ended up going to Europe and visiting all these Eastern Bloc countries at roughly the same time that Oswald was in the Soviet Union. So there's some weird stuff going on there with the family. Connected to Marcello, which means connected to the CIA, because you can't separate the mob and the CIA at this time.
Yeah, but people, it is reasonable for someone to think that Oswald was a communist because he was going to the Soviet Union.
Right. Well, he got on television and said that he was a communist. Right. So why shouldn't we believe him? Right. Of course we can't believe him, because that whole incident with Oswald getting on television was set up in the first place.
Right.
So Oswald, you know, being associated with the Fair Play for Cuba committee, he was told to hand out those flyers on the street corner, right? Well, when you dig into the story of the flyers, you come to find out that Douglas Jones, who owned Jones Printing, who printed those flyers, when he was questioned by Harold Weisberg, basically, he identified Kerry Thornley, not Lee Harvey Oswald, as the man who picked up the flyers. So when you look back at all the correspondence, but allegedly between Oswald and the Fair Play for Cuba committee, it's obviously the whole thing was set up. Oswald had nothing to do with the Fair Play for Cuba committee. His only entanglements with the Fair Play for Cuba committee were those days where he was told to go hand out flyers. Kerry Thornley had the flyers printed and handed to him and told him to go hand them out. Kerry Thornley is one of the two men who was impersonating Oswald all over from New Orleans to Dallas. And the reason the way I was able to determine it was Kerry Thornley is because when you go through these Weisberg documents, specifically on the false Oswald, you'll come to find that you'll find patterns within patterns, right? So of all these Oswald interactions that I determined were not Oswald, you had different personality types interacting with these people. So you had a personality type that was real boisterous and braggart and, just kind of a show off, right? That was one of the personalities that kept interacting with people. And there was another personality that was more of a dick, right? Would be real short with people, snide with them. And it was a totally different personality. And when I came to figure out who these personalities belonged to, they belonged to two men in particular, William Seymour and Kerry Thornley. And virtually every single incident of people that we know of, that we attribute to Lee Harvey Oswald, was actually not Oswald, could be attributed to one of these two men, up to and including Oswald's employment at the Book Depository. There is no evidence that Oswald worked at the Book Depository. And I promise you, he was not there on November 22nd.
So that then who was? That's the question. Who was this? Right. Who was this fake Oswald?
Right. So on November 22nd in Dallas, you have two people impersonating Oswald or being mistaken for Oswald in different places. And that's William Seymour and that's Kerry Thornley. Mm-hmm. So in the morning, you have a couple incidents near the boarding house that Oswald allegedly stayed at. But let me give you a clue. Oswald never stayed at any of the boarding houses that he is attributed to. Kerry Thornley stayed at the boarding houses that Oswald is alleged to have stayed at because he was impersonating Oswald because they were creating this legend of a dissident communist. They were creating this persona. Everywhere these guys went, they talked about shooting guns or talked about communism, even if it was completely out of place. You know, he goes to the store to buy a newspaper and he talks about communism to the guy at the store. It's like, why would you do these things? All over Oak Cliff and all over Dallas, there were seeds planted that this person came in, talked about communism, all this stuff. And back in the 60s, when your driver's license didn't even have your picture on it, it was really easy to interchange people. And you have to think, if someone comes into your store and they buy something from you and they start talking about communism and you don't ever see him again, and then a month later, Lee Harvey Oswald is on television and they're telling you that he's a devout communist, and he kind of looks like the guy who was in your store a month ago, but you can't really remember. You're going to go, I think that might have been that guy who was in my store.
Yeah, yeah.
That's very prevalent. And none of those incidences that are in the documents were ever actually Oswald whatsoever. But on November 22nd, you have Kerry Thornley, who is in Oak Cliff, and Kerry Thornley is ultimately responsible for the shooting of J.D. Tippit, along with David Ferry. Officer Tippit was shot.
Was the cop, right?
Correct. He was the cop who was shot just prior to Oswald's alleged flight to the Texas Theater, which is a whole other setup and staged event. Yeah. And going through all the documents on the Texas Theater, I couldn't even figure out who the first cops on scene were. When you go through all the testimony of people, you have a woman named Julia Postal, who's working at the ticket counter. She never sees Oswald until later when she changes her story to say, oh, I saw him go in and he ran from us and all this. So, like, everybody changes their story after they're given the talk by the Dallas police or whomever. Right.
Right.
So Julia Postal says that she calls the cops to have him come out. But when you look at the timestamps of when that call went out and when it went over the radio and when cops actually showed up on scene, it looks as though cops showed up on scene prior to Julia Postal making that phone call. And I can't figure out who those cops actually were because there's so much obfuscation. The cops who were dispatched, who are credited with being the first cops on scene, most certainly are not. So you have another set up staged event at Oswald. This is the first time we've seen Oswald at all. None of the events we attribute to Oswald were Lee Harvey Oswald until he shows up at the Texas Theater. This is the first time in all of my research that I have actually encountered the real Oswald doing anything. Other than the documents that show that he had relationships with George de Morneshield and Ruth and Michael Payne, and you know that crowd that were basically his CIA handlers. Other than that, like, there are no incidents involving the real Oswald until he shows up at the theater.
What was his explanation for being there then in Dallas? I mean, obviously the fake guy is working at the depository, but he's now in Dallas after being all over the place, Soviet Union, wherever, Mexico City, I think, didn't you say?
Right.
And now he's in Dallas. What is his explanation for even being there? What's his reason?
We don't know. And this is one thing I need to point out. There are a lot of statements that Oswald said this in custody. Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know if I trust any of those.
Right. Exactly. That's my point. If it didn't happen on film, if you don't see Oswald saying it, I don't believe he said it. I think that most of the stuff that's been released to us as Oswald said this is all fake. We can't trust any of it because those guys are all liars. So anything that allegedly would be said by Oswald should just be disregarded.
This is actually the benefit of us being 60 years down the road, because now a lot of people, you know, back then they'd say, well, he said this in custody. And they'd say, well, I guess then he said it. And now if you tell me, well, he said this in custody, I'd be like, well, show me the tape. Otherwise, I don't trust cops. You're an ex-cop.
There were no notes taken.
You don't trust cops.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. There were no notes taken. And if there were, they've never been released.
There's no note. You're interviewing the guy that shot the president and there's no notes taken.
Yes.
That doesn't make any sense.
Right. Oswald, the one thing that I do believe from some of the statements about Oswald was that... he seemed very confused, like genuinely had no idea what was going on, like out of Kafka's The Trial. And so I think that to me speaks volumes that he genuinely had no idea any of this was going on, didn't know this was being set up, had nothing to do. I don't think Oswald was in town to just go work at a book depository or work menial jobs. There are some documents that talk about a guy named Thomas Kane. And Thomas Kane was working with the FBI and being sent on various missions to Canada and a couple other places. And it looks like Oswald was using that alias of Thomas Kane. It can't be proven right now, but there's enough evidence to make me think that there's something to it. And if that's the case, then Oswald was almost never in Dallas. He might have lived there, but he was being flown out to do missions for the FBI. So that to me makes perfect sense, because he definitely was not working at the book depository. And even when they asked him, were you in that building? He gave him a typical spycraft answer. He said, naturally, if I worked in that building. But he didn't confirm that he was in that building, because I can tell you he wasn't in that building. I believe that Oswald was in Fort Worth all morning until he caught a cab to the Texas Theater driven by a guy named Travie Delano Beauclerk. Beauclerk is related to Bernice Click, who was an associate of Jack Ruby. And Beauclerk died in a mysterious, small plane crash in 1967.
Yeah, that happens.
That happens. So when I look at the totality of circumstances, to me, it appears pretty clear that Oswald stayed the night in Fort Worth, stayed there all morning, and then caught a cab to the Texas Theater. It was Carrie Thornley, who was involved with the Tippit shooting and doing all the impersonations in Oak Cliff. And there are about three or four sightings of Oswald that morning in Oak Cliff when Oswald's supposed to be at work. But the real Oswald is nowhere, all right? He's in Fort Worth at this time. William Seymour was working in the book depository as Lee Harvey Oswald. And what evidence do I have for this? Well, there's so much evidence for this. It's unbelievable. And it comes back, first off, I have William Seymour captured in the Robert Hughes film, in back by the railroad yards. So William Seymour was on scene. He was there. And I can tell you Oswald wasn't. I then have, there's an incident allegedly with Oswald on the second floor of the depository where he's encountered by Roy Truly and Officer Baker. And Oswald is drinking a Coke, right, in the second floor lunchroom. That never happened. That's a myth. Somebody made that up out of thin air. That incident actually occurred between the third and fourth floors on the stairwell. And it didn't happen till at least 12:38. So I rewrote the entire timeline of the assassination because the timeline given to us is bullshit. Yeah. They had to shift Officer Baker's story to encountering Oswald in the lunchroom 90 seconds after the assassination had occurred, because they had to cover for the fact that Baker actually made an arrest in Dealey Plaza of the shooter of the at the Daltex building. The shooter at the Daltex building was Emilio Santana, and I'm convinced that he was an anti-Castro Cuban, but he was there on behalf of the mafia. I believe that he was arrested in Dealey Plaza, because we have the Willis 10 photos, and the Willis 10 photos clearly show a man dressed all in black with a rifle getting arrested in front of the book depository. But that is not mentioned anywhere in any of the documents or official story or any of that stuff. So I rewrote the timeline to indicate that that incident didn't happen until 12:38. And then we have allegedly Oswald fleeing from the side of the book depository, where he leaves in a green Nash Rambler station wagon. And the green Nash Rambler station wagon, I trace back to Lawrence Howard, who was a partner of William Seymour. To me, all these pieces fit. I actually identified the two other shooters in the building. On the roof was Sergio Arcacha Smith, the only other anti-Castro Cuban. But again, he was a bagman for the mob, not there on behalf of anti-Castro Cubans. And Lauren Hall, who was part of this trio of Lawrence Howard, William Seymour, and Lauren Hall, who traveled the country back and forth with each other post 1960, because they were all part of this like mercenary group, Interpen, with Jerry Hemming down in Miami. But they most of those guys lived either in Phoenix or in Los Angeles, so they would travel back and forth with each other.
They were like hitmen, like a team of or
they were
contract killers.
Not exactly.
Problem solvers?
They were straight up mercenaries. Most of the time, they were used for training anti-Castro Cubans who were exiles for use on missions to Cuba, which they did. They sent a bunch of missions to Cuba illegally, you know, to go blow stuff up or whatever. And that's what those guys would do. They were all-purpose mercenaries who, you know, when they got out of their service, they didn't know what to do with themselves, right? They were gung-ho, like cold-blooded mercenary types. And what do you do when you get out of the fucking military and you don't know what to do yourself and you want to keep killing people? You go to the CIA.
You go to work for Blackwater.
Right, right. That, yeah, totally. Back then, I don't think there were private agencies like that. But so you would go to the one that there is, the CIA. And that's where they all went. Because the CIA would dole out just infinite fucking money for these people to do whatever. They would pay these guys just to do nothing sometimes because they had nothing for them to do, but they didn't want to lose them as contacts, so they'd keep paying them. I mean, like, it's fucking disgusting how many billions or possibly trillions of dollars have gone on fucking intelligence fucking, you know, bottomless pits.
Yeah. For God knows what. So how many shooters are on scene for this event in Dallas?
A lot.
And so they weren't going to let this guy.
No,
they weren't going to let him get through. He was in a shooting gallery.
Right. There were.
If we were drawing this up like a military operation, he was driving into an ambush.
Yes.
Across like a multifaceted, layered ambush from a bunch of different directions, which explains the reason why he's bouncing all over the place in the car. Right.
Right. So you have four primary locations. You have the shooter at the Daltex building, and the shooter at the Daltex building was actually not inside the building. The shooter was out front, underneath the fire escape. So the shots that were parallel to the vehicle, the shot that hit the curb that struck the piece of concrete, then struck James Tague in the face. We know about that shot. And the shots to Kennedy's back, those shots came from Emilio Santana at the Daltex. It is literally about 4 foot off the ground, the pedestal that he was standing on, and he was hidden in the shadows. But I was able to uncover a man standing there with a rifle when I did some photoshopping and changing of the filters and stuff. So, but then you have the book depository, and you have three shooters at the book depository. On the sixth floor, you have Lawrence Howard and Lauren Hall, the two mercenaries who were hanging with William Seymour. And William Seymour was working in the building as Oswald. And at this point in time, I have him down on the first floor guarding the elevators. Then you have on the roof, Sergio Arcacha Smith, who was a former Cuban diplomat, actually worked in the Cuban government, exiled to America, started working for the CIA, started setting up all of these anti-Castro front companies. Mm-hmm. But it turns out all the anti-Castro front companies were just that. Front companies. They were nothing more than CIA money gathering and laundering operations, because none of these guys gave two fucks about Cuba. Cuba right. is so irrelevant in the Kennedy assassination. I can't even begin to explain it.
Well, but it's a great cover story. It's great everybody story. Everybody was mad about the Cuba stuff, and it makes sense, and you can use that. But again, if the official story is that these guys were mad at Cuba, then you can definitely, or they were Cubans or whatever, then you can definitely count that out, right? If that's the official story, then you know it most definitely had nothing to do with that.
Right. So in the book depository, you have those guys who I've then been able to trace their movements. Actually, I've been able to trace all the movements of everybody throughout the book depository that day. And I can tell you with certainty, like, there was no Lee Harvey Oswald present there that day. William Seymour was working in the building as Oswald. And then you have people like Buell Frazier, who allegedly claimed to have driven Oswald to work that morning. And he had with him a package, allegedly, of curtain rods that he carried into the building. That whole story is fake too. That story was a planned story. Never happened. Buell Frazier didn't drive anybody to work that day. And we know that because of the statements of Charles Shields, who was a Texas School Book Depository warehouse employee. Didn't work in the actual building itself, but across the street in a warehouse. When he sees Buell Frazier come in that morning, Buell Frazier is alone. And he asks him, "Where's your rider?" And he tells him that he dropped his rider off at the front of the building. But that contradicts the story that Buell Frazier has told for the last 60 years, that Oswald walked through the railroad yards with a package under his arm. So Oswald was not there that day. Buell Frazier was a fucking liar. His sister is allegedly the one who got him the job there in the first place through Ruth Payne. So there's some odd familial connections to the Buell Frazier and his sister, Linnie Mae Randall, to intelligence, because Linnie Mae Randall is who got the ball rolling with him, with Oswald allegedly getting the job at the book depository in the first place. But that whole story is a fiction. Like, everything about this damn Kennedy assassination is a fiction that we've been told.
Who was running the book depository? Was it a front company? Was it?
Yeah, of course. So the Texas School Book Depository was the main company that had leased the building. It was a CIA front company for sure. You got to think the CIA is not going to let some Joe Schmo print textbooks. Okay. You really think they're going to let anybody just put whatever they want into a textbook that children are going to learn in school? No, that's where you get stories about the Holocaust and fucking how Lincoln was a great man and all this crap. Right. So, but then when you look at the individual companies in that building, you had Scott Forsman, you had Macmillan, you had Southwest Publishing. And when you research these companies individually, they're all fucking CIA contractors. So the CIA ran that building. It was a CIA front. All four guys who ran that company, O.V. Campbell, Roy Truly, William Shelley, Joe Molina, all OSS during World War II. All of them worked in CIA publishing afterwards, because you got to think CIA controls the propaganda in America. All of it, whether it comes through the news or whatever, books, you name it, the CIA is in control of it. So
unless it's Pearson Publishing and then Bill Gates owns it.
Right. And then there's still connections to DARPA and all that stuff in there somewhere. So like we're totally fucked as far as a culture and society goes. Like, intelligence communities have destroyed us as a people. These people should be fucking drawn and quartered.
Of course.
So when you get past the book depository, you get to the pergola area. The pergola is that big concrete structure. And there were two shooters that I can put at the pergola. You have Dave Yaris, who was a OG hitman. He was responsible for organizing the assassination of Mayor Cermak, Anton Cermak, in Miami back in 1933. And so he's involved. He's old guy at this time, 60, 65 years old. He's then filmed back in the railroad yards afterwards. And behind the pergola, I can't exactly put a rifle in his hand, but I can tell you he was there because he was the tall tramp. And that's Danny Green, the Irishman from Cleveland. So Danny Green, most people, when I talk to him about Danny Green, having worked with the Cleveland mob, they look at me like I'm a moron. But the fucking reality is that before Danny Green went to war with the Cleveland mob, he was part of the Cleveland mob. He worked directly for a guy named Leo Mosseri, who was the old tramp in Dealey Plaza. And that's how I was able to figure out that Danny Green was one of the shooters, because he was a sniper trainer in the Marines. When he got out of the Marines, he went to go work for the Genovese family on the railroads up in New York. He then got basically transferred or traded to the Licavolis in Cleveland, where he went to work for Leo Mosseri. Now, the assassination happens. Shortly after the assassination, in early 64, Danny Green takes over the Longshoremen Union. This is the biggest union in Cleveland, and he's a nobody. He was rewarded. If you go back and use like newspapers.com and search old newspapers, you will find there were a bunch of articles that were written about Danny Green saying, "Who the hell is this guy? Where did he come from? And how did he take over the most powerful union in Cleveland?" Well, I'll tell you, because he was the tall tramp and he was one of the shooters and he was rewarded with that union. So yeah, I put him behind the pergola.
By the way, if people think that that stuff doesn't happen, look at the generals that were involved in 9/11 that when obviously the event happened that were, that should rightly have been demoted. Instead, after 9/11, look at where they got promoted to. So whenever you agree to be a part of this on behalf of the intelligence agencies or empire or whatever, and you do your job poorly, which is, or, you know, you do your job, which is to do it poorly if you're these military guys for 9/11, or do it well if you're a hitman for Kennedy. Afterwards, you can tell their level of involvement by how they're treated when they're elevated in status, when they're given general stars for the way they manage 9/11. Which was a disaster, then you know they're in on it. And much like this, if you see a guy who nobody knows what he's, you know, who he is or what he's doing, but you know who he is, and then you see him all of a sudden get elevated and everyone's going, where'd this guy come from? You know that's how it works. Mm-hmm. Again, so continue on with this.
And so then when we get to the grassy knoll, you have two shooters on the grassy knoll. The first shot that struck Kennedy in the throat did come from the front. It was shot by David Ferry. David Ferry then tosses his rifle to another man named Andrew Jerome Blackman. And then Blackman breaks down the rifle, puts it in a toolbox. This is all seen by a guy named Ed Hoffman. For 50 years, people have debated the identity of the rifleman observed by Ed Hoffman. Well, I can tell you with 100% certainty it was David Ferry. David Ferry was in Dallas. From there, he'll be seen by a witness behind the book depository. He'll then make his way in a gray Plymouth over to the shooting of J.D. Tippit, where he and Kerry Thornley will assassinate J.D. Tippit. And the quintessential grassy knoll shooter is the one and only Jack Valente. And if you want to talk about being rewarded, Jack Valente is the most rewarded guy possibly in the history of the world. So yeah. Jack Valente shot the president from the grassy knoll and then goes to work in the White House that day. It doesn't get much more corrupt than that, does it?
No, he's on the plane with Kennedy and with
Johnson. Yeah,
when Johnson's getting sworn in, isn't he?
Yep, he sure is.
The president, and he's on the plane.
So check this out. So allegedly, at this point, Valente and Johnson have a business relationship only allegedly, because he handled Johnson's campaigns and he handled the 60 Kennedy presidential campaign through his company Weekly and Valente, which is like an ad firm. But by the time that the assassination happens, when you come to understand who Jack Valente is, you come to understand that going back to the 1940s, when he was allegedly in World War II, that he's actually a hitman. He is a spy, and he was recruited probably by Henry Kissinger in his days up in Harvard for intelligence work. But his entire war record's a lie. He's allegedly a bombing hero, flew 50 bombing missions. But I've been able to narrow down his out of all the time during World War II, he was allegedly only in Europe for 4 months of it. So I highly doubt he flew 50 bombing missions in 4 months. The guy's a complete fucking fraud. But he and Johnson had been close since 56. And so the day that the assassination happens, after Jack Valente makes his way to Parkland Hospital, he plants the magic bullet. Okay. He's then grabbed by Cliff Carter and brought to Johnson, because Johnson wants to hire him and put him in the White House. Okay. So, if that's the case, then Valente coming in would be seen as kind of a new guy, and he wouldn't have all of the access to Johnson put before him. He wouldn't be given the keys to the kingdom on day one. However, when you talk to some of the people who were on Air Force One, they say that you didn't get to talk to Johnson unless you went through Valente, period. Ooh. And that was on day one. So that goes to show you on day one how important Jack Valente was.
And Jack Valente is known to the general public best by his job doing what?
He was the head of the Motion Picture Association of America from 1966 until 2004. Let me see if I can explain this. Every person here listening to this grew up in an era where they were propagandized directly by Jack Valente. So
the Kennedy shooter.
The Kennedy shooter, the shooter on the grassy knoll, yes. And he, not only that, Jack Valente directly created the movie rating system, the PG, R, That was Jack Valenti's creation. And that was not done to protect anybody. That was a mechanism of censorship. Because if you didn't hit a certain rating, you weren't going to be put in certain theaters. They put restrictions on where rated R movies could be. Mm-hmm. And they knew that if you got a rated R movie, you were going to get half the exposure. And if you got a PG movie, this is at least in the early days, how this worked.
Right.
And so the entire movie rating system created by Jack Valenti via the CIA, because he was working for the CIA all the way back. That's just enough. That was just a mechanism of censorship.
And we know that the Department of Defense has their own division in Hollywood. I mean, this is known. Right. It's not denied or anything like that. If you want to use the aircraft carriers for Top Gun, then mm-hmm. you've got to give DOD final script approval. That's part right. of the deal. So, well, so the intelligence agencies are there.
There's another thing that I haven't told you this. Maybe I mentioned it in passing, but do you remember the PMRC?
PMRC, what is it?
They were that was the Tipper Gore. And they were trying to get the music for Satanism and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the PMRC was directly funded 100% by the RIAA, the Recording Industry Association of America.
Wait, Industry of America was financing a group to protest against them.
Yes.
That sounds like intelligence to me.
It sounds like intelligence, right? Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the two most well-known board members of the RIAA at the time were Jack Valenti and Charles Bronfman.
Mega group co-founder. Mm-hmm. So we're talking Jewish mob.
We're talking Jewish mob was behind the PMRC. And at the time, remember the Twisted Sister, Dee Snider, came and testified before Congress. Fantastic. All that stuff happened because of Jack Valenti. Jack Valenti was the one leading this charge behind the scenes for the PMRC.
And Jack Valenti is an Italian guy or a Jewish guy?
Both. He's a crypto-Jew. So if you want to figure out that he's really Jewish...
He's a Zionist.
Well, he's a Jew. He's an actual Jew.
Okay.
Because when you dig into his history and his lineage, his sister married Ted Dinerstein, you know, he was involved with all these Jewish organizations directly. So yeah, he was a crypto Jew. His father was a Jew, but in America, you got to think at the turn of the century, a lot of these guys came to the country and they changed their names. They changed how they appeared. They didn't want to appear Jewish to anybody. So they would come in and they would appear like they were everyone else, but behind the scenes, they would practice their Judaism. And that's Jack Valenti in a nutshell. There's a lot more politicians out there.
Nothing wrong with that. If you're Jewish, you're Jewish. And I have no problem with the religion component.
Right.
My problem is not the Jewish religion part of it. Because like I said, half my friends I grew up with are Jewish. I used to have to go to temple with them when I'd spend the night at my friend's house. They'd drag me to temple with them the next morning, you know? And so I have no issues with that. Where my problem comes is with Zionism. And as we've talked about this ad nauseum, you don't have to be Jewish to be a Zionist. Mm-hmm. And so it's more of an Israeli political designation where that group believes something. You know, we believe we should handle the geopolitics differently. And I disagree with the way they handle geopolitics. And again, as I've quoted in the Octopus book, I've got Joe Biden saying, you don't have to be a Jew to be Zionist. I'm a proud Zionist. So it's not limited to that. So I was just curious how that can, you know, listen, I mean, there is that old saying about how the Jews run Hollywood, right? So when you've got a Jack Valenti guy in there, a Zionist who's partnered up with Charles Bronfman, who is a legitimate Jewish mafia guy, it is not unreasonable to suspect that maybe the Jewish mafia is running Hollywood, right? I mean, you've got Lou Wasserman and all these guys. They all have direct mm-hmm. connections straight into the mob.
Lou Wasserman was Jack Valenti's closest friend, from what I can tell. He once made the statement that he said, if you got a problem with Lou Wasserman, you got a problem with me. And so that's how close they were. And then you got to think that is a time when there was a kind of a structural shift in Hollywood where Lou Wasserman, who was controlling Hollywood via Universal Studios, he wasn't with the MPAA, he was with Universal. Jack Valenti then took over Hollywood from Lou Wasserman, but did it as working for the Motion Picture Association of America, not Universal. So yeah, it's an incestuous relationship. All those studios are all in bed with each other. And so it's really It's just one group.
So we know it's not the Cubans, right? Because we know that the CIA was trying to make it look like it was that somebody Cuba related was involved in the Kennedy assassination. But I'll tell you where this leads me. When you start to have a bunch of Zionists involved in the planning of this and intelligence agencies, it was the reason for Kennedy's assassination not having to do with Dimona?
It was 100% Dimona. 100%. Okay. Dimona was...
And explain Dimona for people that don't know what that is.
So starting in 1956, the Israelis via Zalman Shapiro out of Apollo, Pennsylvania, was smuggling hundreds of pounds of uranium from the country for use at a nuclear reactor in Israel. And by 1960, they were outed to the world. Time magazine did a big expose exposing this. So the whole world knew that they were building a nuclear bomb factory. So they kept insisting that it was for peaceful means, like nuclear power, but they wouldn't let inspectors in. They even went as far as to build fake rooms inside the building so as to try to trick inspectors. They were building a nuclear bomb. They knew it. Everyone knew it. And they were stealing the material from us. John Kennedy knew this, and he knew that they'd been fucking us on smuggling operations since the 40s, particularly with the Sanborn Institute. But... Kennedy was done. He's like, fuck these people. All they ever do is lie. They don't come to negotiate. And so many people will think that that speech about secret societies that he gave was about communism. It wasn't. It was about the fucking Israelis. And so when you put it in that context, you kind of understand how he saw them as, you know, using infiltration as opposed to, democratic means and stuff like that. So that's who he was talking about. He wasn't talking about communists. So Dimona was in the works, and he was going to shut him down. And getting rid of nukes was Kennedy's number one priority in the world, and getting the bomb was the Israelis' number one priority. And so he wasn't going to fold. He was going to cut all funding. He was going to basically end the state of Israel. That was what was going to happen. And so the Israelis saw it as an existential threat. And if you know anything about the OSS and Angleton and Donovan and Alan Dulles and these guys, you know, these guys were all diehard Zionists. I don't know when they were compromised, but way, way, way before World War II. But Angleton at the time was the highest level Israeli spy in the American government.
That's James Angleton.
Yeah, he gave us. Yeah, he gave them all of our secrets, all of our secrets. Right. So the CIA, if you don't think so, the CIA runs at the behest of Tel Aviv, just like the rest of our country. On November 22nd, our country came to an end and we've been an Israeli colony ever since. That's why your fucking rights don't matter. That's why all this bullshit woke crap is being pushed, just like it was in Germany in 1918 to 1933. We are living through a recycled bit of history. The current state of America is virtually identical to the state of post-World War I Germany, where you had all these same forces actually trying to undermine the culture, pushing communism, pushing homosexuality and transgenderism and all this stuff 100 fucking years ago. And guess what?
They were doing that in Germany as a tool of destabilization that was happening. And mm-hmm. then you got to be careful when you do stuff like that, because then you get some strongman that pops up out of nowhere and starts unifying the country against the external threats, and it turns into Adolf Hitler. And you have to be very fucking careful about how long you allow this infiltration and subversion of our culture, regardless of who's involved. I mean, at some point, if you just destroy the culture of a country, you're going to have people that are going to try and reformulate it, and they might do so with violence. So it's been fascinating to learn like the role of this, because everybody it's always classic misdirection. It's everybody, you know, it's the Cubans, it's the communists, nobody ever talks about the possibility of it being Zionist led. They never talk about Dimona power plant as being the justification for wanting Kennedy dead. I mean, there's everyone's got a dozen reasons why they wanted him dead, but that it's funny. That one is never one of the reasons that I hear talking about. But when you read it and when you back up far enough and you understand sort of the plan, if you were Israel and you knew that the American president was coming to get you and you knew that everybody else was kind of had problems with him too, boy, you could just whack him and pin it on somebody else and that would be the end of it. And I would suggest that that is what happened.
That's their modus operandi for everything, for 9/11, you name it, all the lone gunman assassins, you know, Kent State, like all this stuff. So
well, yeah, tell people where they can find, like, so the book is coming out. You've got chapters being released. Tell people where they can find this and sure. get ready for, so that they can pick it up when it's fully ready to go, which should be pretty
well. Here's the thing. If you pre-order the book now, this is what you get. You get four chapters that are done. You get access to my private chat. And this is the best part. You get all 630 pages of my notes with full pictures and documents and everything. And honestly, that's worth way more than the fucking book. There's stuff in there that's not in the book. There's a lot of stuff in there that's not in the book. I kind of screwed up by releasing it early.
From writing books myself, I know I have a bunch of notes that'll never make it in there. Stuff that just kind of gets discarded. That's cool. That's valuable. Where can people go for it?
Go to buymeacoffee.com/JFK book. And you get all that stuff for $25. And you get a copy of the ebook when it releases. I'm shooting for March, but it's probably going to be April-ish.
Yeah, I know how that goes. Yeah. You think you're done, and then you start tinkering with it a little bit more, and then you think you're done, and then you got to just, it's never ending. Right. At some point, you're going to have to just decide that the book is done, wrap it up, and like step away from it. Mm-hmm. But what about the website?
You can go to coreyhughes.org, and that has links to all my videos. Most of my work is on Kennedy and the Holocaust. So good stuff.
Check it out. Yeah, you know, light reading. Just Kennedy and the Holocaust. That's all. That's Corey Hughes, everybody. Go check out our show that we do together, Day Zero, where we make fun of people and talk a lot of shit. Support Corey's work wherever you can. If you like this episode, you can share it with your friends and family. You can find me on Twitter @macroaggression or the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thanks, everybody.